Aloha, everybody, and welcome to The Experience. I am your host, Jeremy Vaney, and this is going to be a fun one. This is a solo episode where I answer your questions. That's right. And if I'm too verbose, then we'll just do two episodes of this. Why not, right? So I guess you're interviewing me, technically, in this one. So let's get right into it. Oh, well, actually, maybe let me just self-promote here for a sec. If you're listening to this the week it is released, my book on the Kindle version of my book, I Am to Tell You This and I Am to Tell You It Is Fiction, is on sale for half off until Monday the 21st. So go to the Kindle store and grab that. And it's funny, I looked at, you know, I've talked about that the story of Toe is in that book, but it's also its own book. It's a children's book that I've released separately. And now that I go back and look at the black and white version in I Am to Tell You This and I'm to Tell You It Is Fiction, it looks so foreign to me. It looks like such a draft. It's so weird. I mean, when I first saw the black and white stuff that John Randall came up with, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But now that I've seen the full color spread as a children's book, it's like, I can't unsee that. So, definitely pick up I Am to Tell You This and I Am to Tell You It Is Fiction. And also, consider getting the children's book version of The Story of Toe as its own paperback entity. I mean, you can get it on the Kindle too, but like, really? Children's book on the Kindle? I don't know. I guess, sure, if that's your thing. But I don't know. It's pretty amazing, to me anyway, to see this thing, how it's come to life in these two different forms is amazing. My babies, how they are growing. Okay. Let's dig in. I had put a call out for any questions any listeners had for me. And a number of questions have come in, so let's start with Peter NYC. He asks, any particular reason you chose the Big Island of Hawaii as opposed to other islands in the Hawaiian chain to live in, he's talking about. Also, ever read any of Hank Wesselman's books? He's based in Hawaii now, too. And as a goofy aside, where in Queens, New York, did you live? I'm a Queens native, so I'm most likely the only person on the planet that would care about this. We'll take the last one first. So Queens, when I moved to New York, I moved to New York straight out of college, moved to Manhattan, to Chelsea. And after a year of that hellscape, Chelsea was great, but the sixth floor of a walk-up was just a bug fest. Moved to the East Village, and in the East Village, after a number of years there, it was rent controlled. The landlord offered me on the order of like a lot of money. I'll just say that, a lot of money to move out. So then I moved in with, friends of friends who then became really good friends in Astoria, Queens. And after living there for a good number of years, I moved to Forest Hills, which was amazing. Astoria, not really my cup of tea, for the simple fact that you lose all of your ambition to go back into Manhattan. It's like a pain in the ass to get on the subway and just go back to Manhattan for some reason. And yet living in Forest Hills, which was hell and gone from anything, and actually a 15-minute walk to the subway, but 15 minutes through a neighborhood of mansions, it was such an amazing, beautiful, quaint little place. I lived on Metropolitan Avenue. There was a forest behind me, and there were the rich people in front of me, and there was like a mom and pop like Sunday shop up the road with like a dollar theater. You know, it was like just a cute little place. So those are the places, Astoria and Forest Hills, and all thanks to, I guess, Giuliani. Giuliani turning Manhattan into a Walt Disney World so that prices would go up and my landlord would buy me out of my contract. So living there, why did I move to the Big Island? Well, I had a girlfriend who had a work conference in Honolulu and invited me there to go with her. And this is funny. I don't know if I must have told this on this show before, but and if so, I apologize. But it's a funny little story. So Ted Rowe, I think on Facebook, Ted Rowe, I don't know if he still is. At the time, he was a member of the UFO organization NARCAP, although I guess they'd say UAP, right? That's the new cool kids term for UFO. So he was part of NARCAP, and he lived on the Big Island, and as did Michael Sala, if you know that name from Disclosure. And Michael Sala and his wife were selling, like, come psychically call in the dolphins tours for, like, hundreds of dollars. So you come to Hawaii, you pay them a couple $100, and what, you meditate or whatever it is you do, you psychically call in the dolphins and then swim with them. Ted Rowe, besides working for NARCAP, was also a free dive instructor, and he called BS on them on Facebook, I think it was. If not, then it was a Yahoo group. But I'm pretty sure, or maybe both, who knows. But anyway, he called BS on them and made the offer, hey, if anyone wants to come swim with dolphins, I will take you out for free, and you'll swim with dolphins. Dolphins have favorite hangout joints, and they come relatively frequently to these places. And so I took him up on the offer because I happened to be going to the other island of Oahu. And so decided to stop in a couple of days. I actually got here a couple of days earlier than the gal who invited me out, and spent time free diving with dolphins and Ted Rowe. He was right. We didn't have to use any of our psychic abilities to call in the dolphins. And I just fell in love with the place, and I knew I was going to live here at some point. And then one day I was walking down the street in Forest Hills, and it just, like, hit me, like, it's time to go. At that point, through my spiritual shenanigans, I had actually lost my ambition, my work ambition, which was to work in television, which I'd done for a while. But I'd lost that ambition a while ago. That was the whole reason I could move to Forest Hills in the first place, really, is, like, I'm just going to go there and live my life and work a crap job. And then I just thought, well, if you're going to work a crap job, you could work that crap job in paradise, right? So there's no reason to be in New York unless you have that ambition. So when this hit me, I just packed up and left, essentially. And that's it. I mean, I fell in love. When I was here, it just, like, the energy of the place, it just reminded me of the TV show Lost. Like, everything about it was magical and was, like, calling me back. So I answered the call. And then the question about Hank Wesselman. Hank Wesselman, you guys are probably familiar with him, right? He's been on Dreamland. He wrote, I don't know, originally a book about a potential future life of his in Hawaii, or meeting a native Hawaiian whose future him, but living in California after some apocalyptic event, something. I read the book, and that's my takeaway. I don't really remember. The book I really do remember is The Bull of Light, which is about his time with Hale Makua, who is, well, he's an interesting character too. He's passed away. I never met him, but I guess you could call him an elder. Okay, here's what's funny. There's a lot of Hawaii is different on the inside than the outside. And so you hear about Hale Makua, you hear about, you know, you read about sort of the magical stuff he talks about. And then you meet real elders, and those real elders who knew him when he was alive. And, you know, some revere him, and but some are like, he was a little on the BS-y side. Like, he was sort of hamming it up for the New Age crowd, kind of. And Hank Wesselman, I guess, was sort of in charge of disseminating Holly Makua's information. He hasn't actually gotten around to doing all of it, and a lot of people I know here are upset with him for that. Like, he had promised to write another book, essentially, about how, you know, based on Holly Makua's knowledge or something, and hasn't done it yet. But my read of Hank Wesselman is I went to a book signing of his with the intent of trying to get him to come on the Experience. I think it was the Experience at that point. I don't think I was doing Paratopia. But either way, I wanted him to be on a show. I want to interview him on a show. And having read his books and finding him kind of interesting. But then when I saw him speak, there was something about him that really threw me off. And I can't really articulate what it was, but it just, I don't know, my all my warning signs went up, and I thought, no, I don't want to interview him. And this is before I moved to where I am now, where the people who know him and are upset with him and all of that. I mean, I was an innocent of all of that. There was just something about him, and if I had to say what it was, if I had to pinpoint, it was really that he was sitting on the stage of this bookstore for a really long time by himself and just seemed to be soaking up the attention. He really loved being that guy on the stage, sitting there alone, the focus of everyone's attention. There's just something about it that seemed ick to me. So, and then there was nothing about his energy, man, or whatever, his presentation himself, that seemed particularly spiritual, if I can put it that way, or even like spiritually knowledgeable, but not in a fraud way. Like, I didn't look at him and go, oh, he's a fraud. More like, and again, this is all my opinion at the time. This has nothing to do with anything. If you love him, great, keep loving him. I thought he was kind of a poser. I guess that was my take on it. And then, meeting a Hawaiian elder who I have all the confidence in the world in, telling me, yeah, I knew him. And in fact, I believe I met Holly Makua's sister through him. But anyway, he just sort of was like not impressed, let's just put it that way, with the Holly Makua stuff. And I guess a lot of it was like channeled material, maybe. So not actual authentic sort of Hawaiian knowledge, but just claims of a deep knowledge through channeling. But a lot of people here where I live now in Hawaii, which is still the Big Island, but not the same district, are really into channeling. So they follow that. And a lot of people, whatever they feel about Hank Wesselman, it's like there's like this subculture of people who have sort of deified Holly Makua in a way. So there's also, let's just throw this out there, a lot of sort of jealousy issues around Hank Wesselman, I think. Like, who's this white guy who ended up with, you know, being the bearer of Holly Makua's story, essentially. I'm a little hesitant to talk about all of this because it's probably a longer subject than right now. And I probably don't know enough about all the pieces and the players to do it any justice, but we'll just leave it at that. I'm sure I'll come across Hank Wesselman at some point in life and maybe get a better insight into him than my initial reaction, because initial reactions can be wrong, you know? Anyway, I hope that was a more interesting answer than you were expecting.
We'll be back after this.
This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010 talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia. Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started.
Welcome back.
Let's see. James Day says, let's talk or brainstorm the safest place in the U.S. to avoid climate change. Already people are leaving areas in Alaska, Miami Beach, and Louisiana. The inability to grow grains at scale will lead to the starvation of millions, and the Catch-22 albedo effect means if we stop polluting particulate, then we have no reflexibility and temps will soar. If we keep polluting, well, you know the dealio. Will it become so hot and then boom, we get an ice age like in Whitley's Day After Tomorrow movie and book? Talk amongst yourselves. Well, part of what you're saying there at the beginning is way above my pay grade, unfortunately. So I'll take you at your word. But to the question of, are we headed for an ice age because of global warming? Yes. I believe the answer is yes. And I mean, to me, the inability to grow grains at scale and yada yada, might be irrelevant because the answer is yes. You know, here's the problem. The problem is we've got this mind. This mind has created this mess that it is called evolution. At least since the industrial age, we've thought, oh, we're evolving, right? Of course, we're not evolving. We're inventing. And what we're inventing is death traps for ourselves. Because if there is a key to life, if there is a meaning to life or a thing we're supposed to be doing or getting, we can't with this mind. And so everything that we invent with this mind is a reminder of how unhealthy we are. But we see all of this stuff, all of this invention, all of this artwork, all of this whatever, these sophisticated areas of knowledge that we've honed. We see all of this and we think, wow, we pat ourselves on the back, right? Like, amazing job, everyone. But all of it is a misstep. It's all from this mind that is essentially to wake up or die. I mean, that's it. You wake up or you don't. And the ramifications of not, and it may take thousands of years, and here we are at the end of that, is your demise. You die an unfulfilled species, and then something else gets its shot. I mean, that's my take, anyway. And I think here we are. So that is to say that if it wasn't going to be an ice age that we create or we help foster or help to come quicker without doing anything about, it would be something else. It might be that we end up starving ourselves. I mean, right now, there's an article my wife was reading to me or telling me about something about water being sold on the stock market now as a commodity. Water. So water is no longer going to be considered a right. And we saw this coming a mile away, right? Like, people have talked about this for years. Well, now it's here. So this is what we do to ourselves, right? We're our own death cult. But really what we are is screaming to ourselves to wake up, because you can only be unhealthy again. You can only be cancerous for so long before you kill yourself, before you die off. And so we heed the call or we don't. And I don't know that anywhere is safe for that, right? Like, what does safe mean? I mean, you move somewhere and what? I mean, we've already seen what happens with a pandemic, right? It's like, if this pandemic were The Walking Dead, there wouldn't be bands of survivors getting together and trying to, you know, build a colony or something. We see what would happen, right? Like, a bunch of people get bitten by a zombie. In fact, I wrote this on Facebook. A bunch of people get bitten by a zombie day one. Day two, half the population says they don't believe in zombies. This isn't happening. And day two and a half, they start biting you to prove that it isn't true. And by day three, everyone's a zombie. So that's what happens. Because we're not even as healthy as our worst case apocalyptic imagining of how we would be at the end of the world. We're worse than that, right? We're dumber than that. What we are really, I mean, to not be facetious, is we're crazier than that. We don't know how to be with ourselves. We don't know how to be, period. We are doers. And what we do is a set of routines. And when those routines get interrupted, it makes us on edge. It makes us edgy. When those routines are taken away completely, we have no identity anymore. And now we've got to cling to the next, because the identity is all important, right? We just, this is the product of not having a real culture. Because when I say we, of course, I'm talking about westernized brainiac world. We're not talking about heart cultures. We're not talking about nature cultures or anyone who's living in balance. So this is the issue. And where do you go to survive that? You turn inward. You work on yourself. You work on yourself until you realize that you're the person who self-identifies as one who is working on him or herself. And in that moment, the self is no more. And that is a timeless moment. Now you're out of time. Does any of this apply to you once you're timeless? Well, how are you to find out? And do you care to? To know if you care to isn't to say, yes, I care to. To know if you care to is to confront the entity, confront yourself as you say, yes, I care to, because that person again is trying to do something. So the caring to is equal to the discipline. It is the discipline of watching yourself, watching the machinations of self in the world, of you even claiming you want to be better or you want to do the right thing or all of that. Like, who is the person that is constantly putting him or herself outside of him or herself to say, I want to be different? There is no you being different. There's you and there's not you. Carolee writes, John Randall and Jeremy, Jingleheimer Schmidt. His name was not my name too. No, she didn't say that. This is from the thread, the Story of Toe thread. So Making a Children's Book in a Mad World was the name of the episode where I spoke with John Randall, who did the artwork for the Story of Toe. And she addresses us this way. John Randall and Jeremy, I've been thinking about this interview. Sigmund Freud felt the id to be a part of the human experience slash personality. Was he correct, not correct at all, or only parts of his idea about the id correct? It was all caps. Sorry, folks. If he was right about this, then how do we as a species change that fiercely embedded part of us? Also, if he was right, is this what is wrong with so many people in the world today? Do some people have the ability to get past this while others simply do not have the ability? Only a few thoughts. Thank you for writing, Carolee. Here's the thing. I mean, we can have the discussion about the id, the ego, the superego. And we can say, yeah, sure, there's something about that that's right. Maybe the whole thing is right. But this is within duality, right? This is us breaking up the self into these separate beings, essentially, these separate facets of beings who are sort of in their own right beings for all intents and purposes. So I don't think it's about, I mean, the thing that needs to transform is not changing the id, not paying homage to the shadow and all that sort of stuff. It is, in fact, getting rid of duality. Not you getting rid of, not me getting rid of, but the brain understanding that, I mean, I've put it in terms, of course, of like the seeker who is seeking the great spiritual epiphany or enlightenment or whatever, understanding that that ultimate reality they're looking for transcends and includes them, us, all of us. And so the seeker is a blockage that's in the way of that which is sought. And it makes sense that you would seek because that's what we do, like in life, externally. We seek things out. We solve mysteries. This is how we survive, right? And this is how we build and all of that. But the spiritual does not take that. The spiritual does not work by those rules. People have said that it does. People have built hierarchies and all that, and they're wrong. So all there is awake and asleep. Or all there is the timeless and time. Non-duality and duality. Non-duality, timelessness, transcends and includes duality, separation. So oneness transcends and includes all separations, which is the same as saying timelessness transcends and includes all of time. And what that means functionally is that the body is already time. The body is already in and of duality. So the sense of self does not need to be that. The sense of self can be, right? We can be brain selves or we can be heart selves. Or those can come to an end and timelessness, non-duality, truth, by whatever word you want to use, comes to the fore. And so duality and separation and all of that remains in the world as the body. And the interior experiencing and knowing is that oneness identity, is that timeless identity. This is the case when the separate brain or heart self moves out of the, you know, well, not moves out of the way, but when the body gets it, when the body understands that it is blocking out timelessness with its own projected psychology, with its own sense of self. It's blocking out self, if you want to call it that, which transcends and includes all, the oneness-y thing, with its own sense of self. And you may say, oh, I love that sense of self. That's me. And by all means, go about your business. Just know that the world is ending because of that. This is the part that really gets me, right? I think when all the spirit people of yesteryear were talking about, and you still hear them, you know, what monk, what Eckhart Tolle, what Dalai Lama character isn't going to say, everybody wakes up at their own pace, and whether you do or not, it doesn't matter because what is. Well, you better hope that there's no such thing as reincarnation, pal, because if there is and there's no bodies to reincarnate into, it's going to be an awfully long eternity, isn't it? If you are still self-identified as a ghost in time, right? So let's say what really happened here, which is that these people, at least in terms of yesteryear, now Eckhart Tolle and company, I'm sure, are just sort of echoing what they've heard, and also feel, but that doesn't mean that it's true. But what I'm getting at is like the Jesus, the Buddha, the whoever, they were talking to small groups of people. They weren't talking in terms of the globe. So when they were like, yeah, you've got time, it doesn't matter whether you wake up or not. There's no urgency to whether you decide to do that or not. Life goes on and all of that. They were talking to small groups of people. They're not talking to the entire world at the end of global collapse, right? Or the beginning of global collapse, wherever we are in the process of global collapse. So it doesn't make sense to me to say that now. So I'm a little more urgent about it. And I say it's time to wake the hell up. But to say it with that type of urgency again is useless because that instills a fear. Like wake up or else. And that is where they are correct in what they're saying, which is that you can't have an ambition. You can't have a desire. You can't have a goal in mind for waking up. In fact, you again cannot be the one who wakes up. The self has to hear all of this. The brain and the body have to understand all of this. And then the brain stops projecting you. For the sake of stopping, not because it wants to reach the end goal, not because we're all going to die, even though I believe these things to be true. So all of that is true at the same time. Wait, what was the question about id? You're welcome. Again, you know, you're asking if he's right about the id, how do we change the fiercely embedded part of us? Is this what's wrong with so many people in the world today? Do some people have an ability to get past it? No. What you have the ability to do as a separate self sense is pretend you're evolving, is to change up the guard. I mean, the whole reason that this QAnon stuff works, even though it's ludicrous, even though anyone looking at it with any sense of rational presence in the world can see it's complete garbage, the reason that it still takes such a root in people is because it follows the same lines as Christianity. You've got the invisible savior coming, right? It's so powerfully embedded in us that pattern, that sense of how things are or should be in the world, that it draws way too many people into these things. But if you were to ask a QAnon person, hey, is this Christianity? They'd say, no way. If you were to ask a New Ager, is this Christianity? No, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in religion. I'm above all of that. I see through all of that. Well, no, you've just switched out some of the characters for other characters, right? Like there's still the invisible guy coming down off the mount to give you, your end date, your peace on earth, your great awakening, your whatever it is. So no, any movement that you make is just another movement. And what we need is to be stillness, not to be still, not to try and be still, but to be stillness, to be being in this world. And instead we're constantly trying to do. And we're at the end of doing now. So the ending is coming one way or the other. It's just, is it going to be the healthy version of transcend and include, or is it going to be the unhealthy version of death and destruction? Stagnation. No, I don't believe in Jesus. Have I told you about how the aliens are going to save us? Do we have time for one more? Let's see.
We'll be back after this.
Aloha, Jeremy Vaney here, and I want to tell you about my latest undertaking, OurUndoing.com. OurUndoing.com is a multimedia website where if you watch, if you read, if you listen, without trying to absorb knowledge like we do with normal learning, and without the normal judgmental filters, that we use to compare and contrast so-called spiritual knowledge. If we watch, if we read, if we listen without all of that, we may just wake up to our full human nature. That is what this website is for. It's not about what we're doing, it's about who we are, truly are, when we're off the pendulum of duality. If your life is about seeking truth above all else, look no further. Join me at ourundoing.com.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
Welcome back.
In the comments section of the episode Making a Children's Book in a Mad World, Shiva Cool Stuff writes, "I bought a bunch of Krishnamurti books just because Jeremy talked about them / him, and I found out Kay's not really saying much. Funny books. There's words on every page, mostly, but not really any content on them. My head is just spinning, like the clock is moving forward, but not really going anywhere. My own personal egoic will feels like it is to, quote-unquote, God, what a mosquito's worth is to a human being. They say that the truth is always here presently, and there is not much search needed, really. It is actually quite inspiring. A question to Jeremy, or whoever. Can a person get it without getting that they got it?" Well, interesting question. Let's back up. So I'm not certain what you mean when you say that Krishnamurti's books aren't saying much. I guess I'd need to know a little more about what you mean by that, because I could agree with that in one sense, in the sense that pretty much everything Krishnamurti had to say on spirit or wholeness or whatever word you'd like to use could be summed up in one book or one lecture, right? Like, I think that much is true. The problem is nobody could hear it. And he, as with anyone trying to communicate that, needs to keep saying it over and over again in different words and from different angles. And in fact, that's what I do at ourundoing.com. I call them pathless paths after Krishnamurti's Truth is a Pathless Land. And so they're different writing paths, essay paths, where I write essays and from four different points of view, or, you know, four different sort of overarching topics. So one is about takes a point of view. It's like, you know, essays from within either conversations I've had with people or things I've seen on YouTube or social media, you know, sort of picking up on angles from within communication that I can expound upon. One is scenery from a life. So where I take sort of things from my own life and expound upon those. Talking to oneself, which is the ways in which we talk to ourselves through our inventions and through our own language unconsciously, sort of telling us what we are by providing for ourselves what's missing as far as technology goes. So like the internet equals the interconnection, the interconnectivity that brain people are missing as opposed to heart cultures, that sort of thing. And so forth. So taking different, and one, you know, so the other, I guess, is lessons with nature, where it's, you know, lessons that I'm extracting from my own observations in nature. So it's different strokes for different folks in that sense, but really all of the essays are the same essay in the same way that Krishnamurti, everything out of his mouth was the same thing. in a sense, although I think that I am more so with my books, with urgency and with, I am to tell you this and I am to tell you it is fiction. I'm cheating, or I'm breaking the code of ethics, I guess, as it were. Which is, you'll notice that Krishnamurti never talked about like what comes next. He just talks about the self dissolving and, if there is such a thing as truth, there it will be. And I go further and I talk about some of the what's next and I talk about what unfolds. And in I Am to Tell You This and I Am to Tell You It Is Fiction, I go even further than that and talk about what happens to us after non-duality, like what this non-duality business is leading to. But of course, I'm keeping it hypothetical because I haven't experienced it, so I don't really know. I just know that the information came to me in the same way that truths do, as in, bada boom, here it is, complete. So let's just keep it at that. But the reason that Krishnamurti didn't do that, in my opinion, I guess I should say, but it's an informed opinion, is that he wanted to keep the purity of truth as close to pure as possible. And not, so in other words, not be interpreted, not be expanded upon, not give people a goal. If you say what comes next, then there's a goal and people go, "Oh, I want that," or "Nah, I don't want that." And they think they have a choice. And because we worship choice, we love choice, right? Free will, ooh, that's what separates us from animals. But no, that's not true. Free will is more noise and nonsense. One is either in the flow of truth or one is not. And in the is not is where we are, is duality, is separate things and all that. And so free will, what we consider to be free will, to have choices, is actually a form of confusion. Because you're not in the flow of right thinking, what Krishnamurti called right thinking. And I, in my opinion, I believe Buddha and all of those types of folks, I mean, I think universal is universal, and so they all came to the same thing. But they realized that most people won't get there. And so for them, they wrote out these other, you know, meditations and yoga and paths and whatever that they would say, I would think, are for the masses to be a little bit more balanced, happy, in joy, whatever you want to call it, who are not going to break through themselves. Which makes sense, except I guess what I'm to tell you this and I'm to tell you is fiction would add to that is that perhaps their point of view isn't solely their own, that the universe is alive, is a living, sort of breathing thought construct that takes from truth, takes from the flow, takes from the non-dual, from the timeless, and creates objects in time, creates these paths, these meditations. It essentially, you know, breaks it up as it ingests it through people who have broken through universal consciousness into timelessness, into truth and all that. And so it takes their mega experience and breaks it up into experiences for people in time to have. So in that sense, would any of these Buddha types have a choice? They think they're making a choice. That is their own. Well, I'm assuming, I don't know if this part's true, but I'm assuming they believe they're making a personal choice for how and how much information they disseminate about non-duality. But one could argue that since they are awoken to the universe, you know, the universe is conscious and is them, and they are the universe, and they are conscious as the universe, that in fact, this is the impulse of the universe at large working through them to create these things and set these things up. And when you pull out from that perspective into timelessness, you realize that all of that is just breathing, in a sense. It's just doing. It's not, there's no like nefarious purpose to keep you asleep by taking from the awake state and incorporating it into this dream called the universe. that's just what is, because in the timeless now, all of that taking from a Buddha, taking from a Krishnamurti, taking from a maybe you, perhaps, whatever it is, all of this, which seems to us to be happening sequentially through time, through history, is always already happening all at once from the timeless perspective, if that makes sense. It may not make sense, so buy my book. It'll make more sense in the book, I promise. It always comes back to buy my book, doesn't it? So all of that is to say that I think Krishnamurti saw that the stories and the parables and the instructions and the gurus and all that stuff, they didn't work in terms of waking people up, and that so he kept it pure. He kept it to let's have a conversation. If you follow the conversation to the end and you're listening deeply and you're listening, you know, which is to say openly without any barrier, without any judgment or intention at all to judge or not judge, because trying not to judge is also is a thing that you're doing. I mean, if you're just completely open and listening and having this conversation in you by the end, hypothetically, that should be, you know, you should be doing the work of having the aha moment, of getting it so deeply that the brain shuts off the self, or the body shuts off the sense of self, the ego, the I. And if there is truth, truth be there, because you're the one blocking it out. Unfortunately, as he lamented on his deathbed, nobody who heard him got it. And I explain why that is in urgency, and I probably do it again, and I'm to tell you this. I understand fully because I did get it. So I see exactly where and why and how easy it is to go wrong. And I'll illustrate it within your own post here, and I'm not picking on you. This was what I used to do. This is what everybody does, right? So I hope you see that I'm just trying to be instructive here and not picking on you. It's just that you happen to write this, but anyone could have written this, which is, you say, from my own personal egoic will, my own personal egoic will feels like it is to God what a mosquito's worth is to a human being. When you say that, that's a way to keep you away from you, right? That's like writing about yourself in the third person. When you say my own personal egoic will, what you mean is I feel like I am to God what a mosquito's worth is to a human being. So why do we do that? Why do we have this word that is called, it is ego, right? And because we have this word, we think that we can disidentify as ego. We can keep it separate from ourselves and say, that's the ego, I'm the true me. And that's not how it works. That's not actual reality. The reality is you are ego. Ego is you. It's a thought construct. It's something that the body is projecting. I mean, neurologists, materialists are kind of right on that. Where they're wrong is that the body exists within consciousness and is projecting more consciousness. So they would not say that the body exists in or manifests within consciousness. They would just say that consciousness manifests within the body. But they're wrong. And so when you say, they say that the truth is always here presently and there's not much search needed, really, it's actually quite inspiring. That's unfortunate. And again, that's something that a lot of people would feel. They would feel maybe inspired by that. But the point is to not act on anything, to not, because the self, the ego, I, you, are constantly trying to remain alive, egoically alive. So while the body is alive, the self can die. And in this death of self, what happens? Ooh, truth. Whatever, you know. But the self does not want to die. The self wants to add truth to it. You want to add truth to you. You want to search as little as possible And then just find it, right? But all of this you-ness, the search and the seeker, which are one, you are the problem. You are the blockage holding back that which you seek. So when you ask, can a person get this without getting that they got it? Well, intellectually, you can get it. Intellectually, I could articulate this in such a way, if I haven't already, because maybe it's too convoluted for this, you know, for this format. But let's say I articulated it perfectly. I would say Jiddu Krishnamurti articulated it perfectly. And here we are. You're still asking this question. So obviously it didn't affect you. You may get it intellectually, but that does nothing. You have to essentially deeply, the brain has to be so deeply affected by it that it shuts you off. You power down, little robot. So no, you can't get it without getting it, without getting that you got it, on the ultimate level that we're talking about, because the act of getting it is the act of death. So the getting it is the death of self. And Krishnamurti would leave it there. And then I would tell you, but don't worry, because the self resurrects, self 2.0, in the very next moment, blah, blah, blah. And that's a mistake in a sense, because it may give you a sense of comfort. Like, oh, good, continuance, we go on. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's like it gets in the way of you ever getting this so deeply that you do, quote unquote, die. Because it already gives you this future that you can that you become, like a heaven, right? So what I'm doing in that sense is, you know, maybe, I don't know. I mean, I struggle with, like, okay, am I doing the right thing or not? But the reason that I still talk about the stuff that is probably taboo, and Krishnamurti even would probably say, don't listen to that guy, even though he knows it to be true or knew it to be true, is that I think at this point, even though we're not that far off from the 1980s when Krishnamurti died, we've still come a long way in terms of, like, all the information we've consumed from the East and from the Middle East and from, you know, mystics and Gnostics and whatever other icks, all this spiritual knowledge, on paper, at least, knowledge. Some of it true, some of it not true, who cares? The point is we've consumed so much of this. And so many of us have lost our facility to even want to read subtext. We just want everything literal. We want it right there in front of our faces where we can, just like robots, get the text, get the instruction manual. That I'm trying to cater to that mind, which I think is slightly different than people who used to, like, come out and listen to Krishnamurti talk or listen to any of those guru types talk, because they were legitimately searching. Now we're at a point where no one's legitimately searching. Well, I mean, some people are. I shouldn't say that, obviously. But far too many of us have given up on that because we want the so-called glory or the feeling of power and control that comes with claiming to be a master, claiming to be the one with knowledge. Not knowing that knowledge is the farce that is in the way of clarity. So I'm trying to break through to even that person and say, it doesn't work the way you think it works. And this is how it works. So I guess essentially it's like I'm enticing people who have some sort of knowledge or believe they do about these subjects with the candy of the actuality of it. And in hearing that, they'll be like, ooh, I need to listen to this guy, because unfortunately that's what we need in this day and age, to entice people to listen at all. And especially through their own, the noise, their own noise and nonsense of, I already know, I've already mastered. How do you break through to that person except with the enticement of, no, no, there's more, but wait, there's more, but wait, you're wrong, and this is how it works. but probably, you know, I mean, the self wants to remain the self. And so odds are, if I have to step back and look at it, I would say probably that won't work either, because people will just take of that and what they want and discard the rest like they do all the time and go on with life. It's very, very few people, unfortunately, who break through it all, because the self is so cunning that even the self that does get it intellectually, the person, you, who does get it intellectually and says, oh, yeah, I get it. Now, I really wish that were me. Even though I understand that the me is in the way, what I mean is I wish that I would dissolve so that truth would be the case. I mean, all of that wishing, that desire, that, you know, is the thing in the way. And so it's like you've constantly got to be disciplined enough to stay one step ahead of yourself to make your unconscious motives conscious. You must be conscious. And once you're conscious, you're conscious. You're awake, right? So I hope that makes sense. Probably I just made your head spin more, and that was not helpful. But it's so funny how hard it is to articulate simple things. I get bogged down in, you know, some people think I over-intellectualize or something, but really it's just that, like, okay, Krishnamurti said it. Truth is a pathless land, you know? That's it, the end. There's no way to get there from here. Because paths lead to finite, you know, points in time, points in space, and truth is alive and always on the move. Truth is the ever-present case for which those paths lead to dead ends. I mean, they lead to their own thing, you know, meditation and yoga and all that. They do maybe what they say they're intended to do, unless they say they're intended to lead you to truth or activate your kundalini, or, you know, in the way that it must, you know, in a healthy sense, not just turning over the engine and, you know, going, oh, look, we're driving a car. Well, no, you're not. You just turned an engine over. I don't know. This is getting a little out of hand here. Beyond what you're asking here. Point is, you can't get it without getting that you got it, because the you who's doing all this getting is the one who dissolves. And you can't not know that. Because that is what you are. You can't not be that. And just saying that, again, do I have to write anything else? Do I have to say anything else? Well, yeah. And this is where I end up over-intellectualizing, right? Because people can't hear that. Doesn't matter how simple or how complicated, how abstract, how in-your-face literal. Nobody wants to understand this or we'd all be awake. We want to comprehend it. We want to make a study out of it. We want to talk about it in groups. We want to control it. We want to add it to us. We want to be that. We don't want to die for that to be. The end. Anyway, on that happy note, that is the end of this week's show. Next week, we're going to be talking to Nick Redfern. 'Cause I have questions for Nick Redfern. Oh, yes. And he has kindly obliged me to answer them. So we're going to do that. And then I think the following week, I'm going to do this again, because there was another set of questions that I really wanted to get to. But of course, I've already overbloated this show with my voice. So we'll do that in 2 weeks. All right. Thank you all. And if you have more questions, keep them coming, because now that I think about it, this set of questions probably won't be a full episode. So keep questions coming, and I'll keep answering them to the best of my ability. All right. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next episode. Now that I think about it, I don't know if it'll be next week because of the holidays and whatnot. Who knows when things will get posted, but whatever the next episode is, will be Nick Redfern. All right. Take care.